Okay, the meeting will come to order. I think we woke up Representative Paymer. A little bit shocking. I think how we'll proceed today, Representative Paymer, is I'm going to move, since the bills are so similar, that I'm going to move House File 180, 890, 1584, and 1900 to bring them before the committee for possible inclusion in the Property and Local Tax Division report, and then we'll go through and hear them kind of let you start and present yours, and that way we can have a pretty thorough discussion of these since they're all pretty similar, but yours is a little bit different, so... Representative Paymer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. House File 180 eliminates the phase-out of limited market value. Minnesota has a long history of cushioning the blow of property tax increases. The impact of huge property tax spikes, especially on people with fixed incomes, has historically resulted in legislative action. People are already realizing significant property tax increases due to school levy referendums and increases in county and city taxes, in part because of reductions in LGA and other state aids. Now, if you couple local property tax increases with the phase-out of LMV, homeowners and cabin owners will face extreme hardship. Poor cities are growing. People with varied incomes are moving back to the central cities, and this is a good thing. In St. Paul and neighborhood after neighborhood, the market values on homes continues to escalate, but the income of many homeowners isn't rising commensurate with the market value increases. This is especially true for senior citizens. People who buy, for instance, a home in Eagan know the property tax rate when they purchase it, if they buy a $350,000 home. But someone who has been living in an older neighborhood, for instance, in my neighborhood in McAllister, Groveland, in St. Paul, or in Highland Park, for 15 or 20 years, and they want to stay in their home, they may simply not have the income to pay these taxes. LMV protects homeowners because of sudden increases from assessors, reevaluating homes, or increases solely because the neighborhood becomes hot. Now, I don't know if LMV is the best or the fairest way to deal with this problem. I listened to the tape of your earlier committee hearing when Mr. Salamone presented on the on LMV, I listened to the whole tape, so I would defer to the collective wisdom of this committee that knows far more about tax policy than I do. But if you can't support this bill or the others that you'll be hearing that seek to continue LMV in some way, then let's find another mechanism that mitigates rising property taxes that results from rapidly inflating property values. So, Mr. Chair, with that, if I could, I'd like my witnesses to provide some brief testimony.
Representative Paymer, did you get the impression that Commissioner Salamone wasn't supporting our bill?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that the whole discussion was quite interesting. I wasn't sure if it's what Mr. Salamone was actually, what his bottom line was, but I know that it's controversial because it appears that there's winners and losers when you have LMB.
Okay. Yeah, if you have individual testifiers, we do want to kind of avoid being too repetitious, but go ahead.
Okay, my first witness is Councilmember Pat Harris, who is in Ward 3 in St. Paul.
Oh, excellent. Councilmember, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Thank you to Representative Paymer for offering this important measure for St. Paul. I will be very brief. I also want to thank Mr. Carlson from the League for being here. He's going to talk about it briefly as well.
Well, Mr. Councilmember, if you're testifying just to one bill, then... you don't have to be worry about being too brief. I mean, you know, too long-winded. We're more concerned about having the same people testify four times. So
I'm a one-timer.
Feel free to.
This is definitely an urgent issue for homeowners in St. Paul and for homeowners all over the state of Minnesota. The current phase-out plan is putting homeowners at risk levels of double-digit property tax increases. In St. Paul, some of those levels are over 20% of potential property tax increases for our homeowners. Without an increase in city spending, these people are facing a risk of high property tax increases in St. Paul. In a period of slow economic growth, sharp increases in property taxes cause undue burdens on homeowners, with an even greater burden on those individuals living on moderate, low, and fixed incomes, as Representative Tamar had indicated. In a slow economy, that equals stimulative interest rate environment, which equals rising home values, which equals high taxes. And in that slow economy and in that stimulative Fed interest rate policy environment, we have a situation where home values are definitely rising, coupled with the elimination of the limited market value, and we are seeing tax increases in neighborhoods across St. Paul and across Minnesota that are unbearable for citizens. As interest rates begin to rise, home values begin to stabilize, and limited market value in its existing format begins to work. And so the city of St. Paul has taken a position to reinstate the limited market value as a tool to protect against sharp increases in property taxes. And commensurate with Representative Tamar's comments, we also request that the legislature engage in a study to determine a method of preventing artificial valuations that would not result in tax increases that would be detrimental to homeowners and to the affordability of the community. In a nutshell, this is important to the city of St. Paul. Ramsey County is considering a similar position. This is an issue that, because of the current confluence of the economy with low Fed interest rates, slow economic growth, and rising property values, this is the wrong time for citizens of Minnesota to experience these increases. So once again, I thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I look forward to having a continuing discussion.
Any questions for the council member Harris? Members. I guess I do have one. We've heard a lot of criticism of limited market value and some statistics that show that if this is kept in place, that it actually raises more people's taxes than it lowers. Have you heard any of that discussion, or do you have an opinion on that?
Mr. Chair, can I
certainly
respond to that? I was looking at the report that Mr. Salamone presented to the committee, and I think, you know, I can't dispute the fact that more homeowners, if you eliminated LMB, would pay less. But if you look at the amount of that they pay versus the amount of the people who are homeowners who have been protected by LMB, the actual dollar amount is far more significant. So in other words, someone who lives in my neighborhood, St. Paul, if you eliminate LMB, they're going to pay a lot more in property taxes as the individual in another community who might have to pay who may gain a small amount because of the elimination of LMB. If that gets to your question.
It does, Representative Paymer. Thank you. And members, I want to point out that you should have in your folders, I asked for a printout of the smallest political subdivision in your districts, so that you could look at the assessed value, sale price, and actual sale price of different properties and look at the variances that are there. And Representative Paymer, if you want to look at any of these, feel free, because I think it also might indicate that if they're, you know, eliminating limited market value might actually cause a shift onto the properties that were most recently inspected and assessed. But there is quite a variance. Usually some of these are 50% or more. So you look at those as we go forward. Any other questions for Representative Paymer or his witnesses?
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like Gary Carlson to make some brief comments about my bill.
Certainly. And Representative Paymer, you can feel free to stay here and as we discuss the other ones too.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'll be a one-time testifier as well. We generally, the League of Cities policies were modified this year, and generally we support the concepts embodied in the four bills here today. So the comments I will make, I think, could apply to all four of the bills. Most specifically, though, I'm here to testify on behalf of Representative Paymar and House File 180, I should say. And let me say that the League's policy position on this issue has changed. A few years ago, Representative Paymar reminded me that we were up testifying against this very bill, and I want to explain why our policy position has changed. And let me go back in time just very briefly. We enacted the phase-out of limited market value during the 2001 legislative session. In 2001, the total value excluded from tax under limited market value was right around $10 billion. In the years since the phase-out was enacted, the limited market value exclusion actually grew to a peak of $35 billion in the year 2004, and now in 2005 we've begun to phase out that value. But our position has changed, I think, largely because the magnitude of the issue got much larger, and now the issue before us is how do we transition that $33 remaining billion of home, cabin, and apartment value back onto the tax rolls. We would support the idea of reinstating the existing or the previous law as embodied in House File 180. That would allow a maximum increase of 10% per year or 15% of the difference in assessment. And we believe that in the current interest rate environment and with the cooling of housing prices, that system may allow us to ultimately phase out the $33 billion of remaining value more rapidly than we saw during the early part of this decade. Let me point out one additional thing, though. One of the ideas that the League of Minnesota Cities has discussed and would leave for your consideration is whether the targeting program, it's another tax policy program that we have in place, whether that program could be modified to help reduce or buffer the impact of rising home values. The targeting program right now requires that the state pay a homeowner if their tax is increased by more than 12% per year or more than $100. The state would pay 60% of the difference over that 12% increase. That is a program that could be considered for expansion as a way to help buffer the tax increases that could result from rising property values. But let me just summarize by saying that we do support the ideas of helping to buffer the rapidly rising values, or now I think the problem is the reinstatement of the value that has been excluded over the last 4 or 5 years. And we think Representative Paymar's bill, Representative Vandeveer's bill, Representative Mullery's bill, and Representative Lanning's bill would all help us accomplish a more orderly transition for that $33 billion of excluded value. With that, I would stand for any questions.
Members, any questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, does the that target refund program apply to cabins, recreation? Does anyone know that? Maybe that.
No.
Okay, so that's. So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Marquardt.
So, Mr. Carlson, when you talk about expansion, could that include? What's your thoughts? I'd like you to flush that out a little bit because I'm intrigued by that. That might be an approach that we could look at.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt. When we talk about an expansion of the program, I guess most specifically we could find a way I was thinking of finding a way to help the homeowners, but I suppose the legislature could certainly consider helping cabin owners or apartment owners or other property owners that are benefited under the limited market value program by extending that. The one note is that we would most definitely have a fiscal cost of expanding those programs. It would be a direct cost to the state budget if we did that. But that would be a way to consider addressing the rapidly rising values out there, and you could include, I presume, many different classes of property.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlson, one of the things we're looking at is the actual number, whether it's 10% or 20 or 15. And, do you have any thoughts or rationale as to what that number should be? That you could give us any thoughts on? Or,
well, Mr. Chair, I think one of the goals of limited market value back when it was created, recreated in 1993, was really to provide a kind of temporary, orderly phase-in of rapidly increasing values. And clearly that number depends upon a number of market factors. I think what we saw happening in the early part of this decade was that home values were exceeding the 10% phase-in provision within the existing law, and we were building up an excess of limited value. Really, probably what would need to happen would be to have the phase-in percentage somehow tied to maybe average increases in home values or interest rates or some other factor, make it a more dynamic percent increase to prevent, as we saw last year, $35 billion of value from being excluded from taxes. Mm-hmm. But how you set that, I really don't know. I would leave it up to smarter people than me, like Karen Baker or Steve Hines, who maybe have studied trends in home values. I know your bill has a 12% phase-in in it, and that probably would have a less of a chance of building up these enormous amounts of excluded value. But it also runs the risk of having higher tax increases from year to year for property owners.
Mr. Carlson, do you have any opinion on whether what properties should be included, or any objections to including, or any rationale for that?
Mr. Chair, we don't have any specific position about what types of property should be included. I know your bill does extend limited market value to all classes of property. I think if you go back in time, you'll see that in the period 1975 to 1979, we had a roughly similar provision in state law that applied limited market value that applied to all classes of property. I think House Research could confirm that. I do not recall what the percentage increase was under that law. I think it was around 10 or 15%. I see Steve doesn't remember either. That was a little bit before my time. But, I think that if the rationale is to help buffer increases for property owners, applying it to all types of property certainly may help buffer those tax increases that would otherwise result.
Okay, thank you, Representative Paymar. Do you have any comments on that? Any of these questions? How did you arrive at your magic number?
I just brought us back to 2002 level, and basically I guess the bottom line for me is that I think a 10% increase is reasonable on top of all of the other increases that our homeowners are going to be paying relative to property tax levy increases are passed, and increases in city and county taxes are bundled into the burden of homeowners. So that's how I came to my 10% number.
Okay, thank you. Representative Simpson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have to ask this question. I'm sitting here and looking through I had some charts sent out to me about cities and towns in my district, and as I read through these, my townships and my cities, after eliminating limited market value, will all drop. I will see actual drop in the taxes paid. But then if I go through and page through my cabins that are in that same area, every one of those are increasing. So I need somebody to give me why are my taxes dropping on my towns, in my townships, and not on my cabin. I need somebody to give me that rationale.
Sure, Mr. Representative Simpson, maybe House Research can do better too.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Pardon? Where did you get the chart, Mr.
I had, these were sent to me.
Oh.
I've had these for a while. It came from the seasonal rec people, MSPRO.
Mr. Chair, I could take a stab at answering that question.
If you'd like to, Mr. Carlson, or we They will be coming up, though, to testify, and you could maybe get the answer then, but if you want to take a swing at it.
Mr. Chair, members, I think what's happened is that a lot of the cabin property have a greater percentage of their value excluded under the limited market value program. So when you eliminate the program, what would happen is the increases on homes would be smaller, or the reinstatement of value for homes would be smaller than would be for cabins, and cabins would ultimately absorb more of the property tax. So I think if you were to look at a typical cabin, you know, up in the New York Mills area, you probably would find that it may have 20 or 30% of its value excluded from taxes under limited market value, whereas a typical home may only have 5 or 10% of its value excluded. As a result, the taxes would shift from the homes to the cabins as their values increase more rapidly. And that, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, that is a phenomenon that I think would be not only in counties like Otter Tail, it would be in counties like Crow Wing, Cass, St. Louis County that have a preponderance of seasonal recreational cabin property. And many of those properties have certainly benefited because of the limited market value statute.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Representative Mullery, would you like to join Representative Paymar, and we can talk about 1584?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I hate to abandon the committee, but I have to be on another committee meeting. So
okay.
But thank you very much for hearing my bill.
Certainly, thank you. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. Mr. Chairman, Steve Larson is with me this morning from the mayor of the City of New Brighton, representing the North Metro Mayors Association. Mr. Chairman, I think everybody knows the issue on the limited market value. In general, my bill targets it a little more at the homes that are being hit in the metro area by a combination of not just the phasing out of the limited market value, but are the most affected by the 01 tax changes and things like that. And Mr. Chairman and members, there's a map here of the city of Minneapolis. Hopefully everybody can hear and see me. The red areas are the ones with the over 30% of increase in the limited market value because of these changes. As you'll notice, most of the north side and northeast Minneapolis and the central core of South Minneapolis are the ones that are being hit. It's all of the areas that are your highest crime areas, highest problems of at-risk youth. All of the most problems in the city are in the areas that are being hit the most right now. And I haven't seen this for St. Paul, but it's probably similar. And also, I know that from talking to people in governments in the North Metro, it's quite similar to what's happening in their areas. So what's happened by a combination of things that have been done to them is a compacting of problems, and yet these are areas which we're trying to stabilize and actually get people to invest in, and yet it's becoming very hard for families, especially seniors living in these areas, to remain. And Mr. Larson would like to give the statement behalf of the mayors.
Mr. Chair, committee.
Mr. Larson.
It's a privilege. I'm Steve Larson. I'm the mayor of New Brighton, along with being the mayor of the North Metro Mayors Association. I'm the president of that organization. Come to you today to support passage of the House File 1584. I do not present myself as a tax expert, but I do come before you out of concern of what is happening to the average homeowner in our communities. In past discussions of LMV, value has tended to highlight a few specific markets, notably the seasonal rec properties, as was discussed previously, lakeshore homesteads and moderate value homes in the inner city. This is no longer the case. The phenomena of rapidly increasing residential homestead properties is now increasingly becoming a fact of life in many inner ring, fully developed suburbs such as New Brighton. When you think of this, it does not come as much of a surprise as modest home prices in the center city become too expensive for many to consider, the next turn to similar homes in adjacent second and third ring suburbs. Single-family homeowners in my city have experienced a significant market value increase in their prospective value. We, in fact, have gone from 171 in 2002 to 232 in 2005. That's a dramatic increase. Other cities in the inner ring suburb, north metro areas such as Robbinsdale, Frisco, New Hope, older portions of Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, Spring Lake Park, and Moundsview are experiencing similar trends. Generally, it's good. It's a positive sign of our homeowners and long overdue for our community that property values are going up. But I can assure you that the average income of our residents has not increased at the same volatile rate. Thus, the homeowner capacity to pick up the increased tax cost due to these increases is becoming more severe. I do realize that we currently have several programs in place to try to address these pressures, including the circuit breaker and property tax refund program. And limited market value is one more tool to try to address this problem. As a tool, it has the advantage of being automatic for the homeowner. No second step is needed to secure the help being offered by this tool. It also is a tool which comes into play at the first step in the process, a notification of value. House File 1584 would keep LMV with the added advantage that it would limit its availability by excluding the most expensive properties as outlined in the bill. Such, I would ask you to support it and retain the concept of LMV. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mayor. Representative Muller, did you have any comments you'd like to make?
Mr. Chair and members, I have no further testifiers. Basically, that's the point of this bill is if we're not going to do it for everyone, it's extremely important at least to do it for these lower priced houses. The combination of what we've done over the last few years is really causing havoc in some of our most needy areas.
Could you talk a little bit about, yours seems to be different in regards to so it provides for maximum percentage increases that vary based on the market value?
I'm
looking at the pardon me. Yeah, the research summary, and it talks about the fact that your percentage increases vary based on the market value of the property in the preceding assessment year.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What it would do is retain it at 11% for properties less than $325,000, and then for over that up to $750,000, I believe the 25, Ms. Baker can answer that, but I believe that that was the figure that we have under present law, I think. Isn't that where that came from?
Well, Representative Mullery, if the idea is that property taxes are not necessarily, or homes' values aren't necessarily related to income, this seems to make the assumption that they are.
Mr. Chairman, they aren't necessarily related to. There's certainly a correlation, I believe, that there's no question. I think there's certainly a correlation and looking at the in Minneapolis for sure that seems to be the case, and in looking at the surrounding suburbs that I know of, it seems to be the case. There's certainly exceptions to anything we do.
Any other questions for Representative Mullery or the mayor? Representative Simpson.
Probably just a question, Mr. Chairman, for maybe Ms. Baker. What on the revenue note on these, what is targeting refunds? What is considered targeting refund?
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, what targeting refers to is the refund that you can file on the PTR refund form, and it is if your home goes up by more than 12%, or I'm sorry, if your property tax now, not value, goes up by more than 12% and $100, so you have to reach the $100 increase also, then the state will refund a proportion of the difference, and it's 60% of the difference. And that is not income related. So as opposed to, you know, the property tax refund has an income threshold, the targeting does not. So it that is what revenue is referring to on their fiscal note here. And the reason that the cost goes up is because if in fact under current law, it goes down, because what it's doing is it's holding down the property taxes on those homes, so their increase is not going up as much, so they aren't qualifying for targeting, because the $1.2 million, the $2.2 million, and the $9 million are savings to the state.
Sorry, Representative Rukavina.
So, Ms. Baker, the... One parentheses, I thought it was the savings. That's the cost?
Right.
Okay, so then it's the savings because of the target. What is the total targeting annually or a biennium under that same program you described to Representative Simpson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, parentheses is a cost to the state. Okay? And targeting varies so much. I mean, there isn't a trend in targeting. I think, you know, there's some years where targeting is $1 million or $2 million, and the next year it might be $7 or $8 million. So I don't know if I've got the actual, maybe I do have, yeah, we can find it. But targeting really varies. It's not easy to trend like property tax refund.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To this point, do we know Ms. Baker, do we have any sense as to what percent of the property owners that are eligible for that refund are actually filing for it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, no, we really don't have any way of knowing. This is something that if, in fact, they don't qualify for PTR and they're not familiar with the PTR form, they may not know about targeting. However, it is something that shows up on the back of the property tax statement, and it's been around for a long time, so there's been a lot of publicity on it. And I think various members that I've talked to, when there are large tax increases, they send out a lot of mailings and stuff to the district saying, make sure that you file for this if your property taxes go up by more than 12%. So, you know, I think a lot that do qualify do file, but we just don't know what percentage that is.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a sense that in spite of efforts to let people know that there's a large percentage of eligible folks that are not doing this, and therefore saving the state money, but, you know, how fair is that when others are getting it and many others are not even aware of it?
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Baker, the targeting also applies to seasonal rec property. It doesn't? Just the homestead property?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Lanning, House File 1900, if you want to. Representative Mullery, if you do want to stay, feel free to do that. I don't know. join us at the table to continue arguing as to why yours is better than Representative Lanning's and mine. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 1900 is probably the most modest of the LMB proposals you have before you today.
That might make it the most popular with Representative Abrams.
I'm just a modest guy, so. In an ideal world, LMB should not be necessary. It's not the best policy. But we don't always live in an ideal world, and I don't think we do currently. In reality, today we still have a large number of properties that are seeing extraordinary value increases on their property. It's not at all uncommon for my constituents, particularly those who have seasonal recreational property, to be experiencing 20 to 30% increases each year, and this has been happening for quite a few years. These valuation increases are raising a lot of concern among our constituents around the state, metro as well as rural. And I guess I believe, Mr. Chairman and members, that if we don't extend this limited market value, at least in a more modest way as I'm proposing, that we're going to experience a tax revolt maybe like we haven't seen before. My bill buys some time to see if these value increases will continue to escalate at the rate that they've been escalating. Perhaps they will no longer be experiencing 20 to 30% increases due to economic conditions, whatever. What my bill does, if you look at the House Research Bill Summary, under current law, the percent for 2005-06 is at 15, and then 33%, the percentage of difference between previous year LMV and the current year's EMV. Next year it's slated to go up to 50%. And what my bill does is freezes it for 1 year, 05-06, at 15 and 25, and then has it go from at 15 and 33 for the next 2 years, and then the repeal would be 2009-10 and thereafter with respect to the bill. If you look at the revenue note, the cost for the first 2 years is $2.3 million and then $2.8 million, but due to the factors that we just discussed a moment ago, there's a revenue gain in the third year of $4.8 million. And so in a way, you could look at this as it's costing us something now, but is going to save us something in the third year. The fiscal note shows negligible impact both to the state and local units of government. I want to add just one other thing with respect to the shift issue. And this is illustrated, I think, by the question that Representative Simpson raised. And I happen to be a seasonal recreational property owner in his district, right on the edge of his district. What's particularly interesting to me is that a lot of the townships and cities in his district will see their property taxes, the homesteaded property, will actually go down. And in a township that and town that is in my neighborhood, it goes down by 4.2%, or there's no change at all if LMV is excluded or eliminated. Whereas the seasonal recreational property in the same township and city is experiencing 25 and 30% increase if LMV is eliminated. That's an extraordinary shift, it seems to me. And and the last point I guess I want to make about LMV is a point I raised the other day in our discussion, is that you know, in reality, with these rapidly increasing values, all of the property taxpayers in a jurisdiction have been benefiting from this. The tax base has been growing rapidly, and therefore that's a benefit to all of the property. And what we're talking about here with my bill is to provide some relief by just slowing down some of those increases a bit. It seems to me this is a reasonable approach to the issue that's before us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Representative Lanning. I'm just going to go through mine real quickly. The difference is House File 890 members, probably the biggest difference is it includes all property types. And it's permanent, and it's a little bit higher at 12%. And it also allows a faster recapture of homes that resell. So that if they go from one owner to the other, there can be a faster escalation in the value. And the reason that I think this is important, and I agree with Representative Lanning, in a perfect world, if assessments were accurate, up to date, all the time, then we probably wouldn't need this, because you wouldn't see the kind of shifts that I think occur because of the nature of assessing, and it would cost substantially more to increase the accuracy of that, more than likely, to get it more reliable. And what ends up happening, and you can look at the runs that I had done for you that are in your packet, and we'll ask someone from the department to come down here and talk about them, but I think a tax that's not based on ability to pay at all, that has the ability to double or more in 1 year, is certainly can be traumatic and is probably not the best policy. So the purpose of my bill with the 12% and covering all property is to hopefully, one, kind of slow down what I would call political shifting of values, maybe onto other classes. There's been a lot of brokers and other people that have expressed to me that since we did tax reform, that commercial, industrial, and some of those properties, the assessments have gotten more aggressive on those, because that tends to take the pressure off the residential. So I think including all property types makes it probably fairer also. But is there somebody from the department that could come down and explain the sales reports that we have in our packets? Yes. And
Mr. Chairman, John Hagan with the Department of Revenue. In each of your packets, in a meeting with Representative Vandeveer, had asked us to develop sales ratio information for the smallest jurisdictions. In other words, in Representative Marquardt's case, we would not do a run for Clay County. We did Dilworth instead. So you don't have huge volumes of paper. We did the run for the smallest district for all classes of property. In addition to that, I apologize for my voice. In addition to that, we broke out on a spreadsheet the frequency distribution of residential sales for that jurisdiction, which is, if nothing else, attractive to look at.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Hagan, is this all classes of property? It says residential on the cover.
The cover is just residential. The run is all classes of property. So when you get back to the towards the end, and if you look under column...
2, 3, 4. The one that says property type?
Right. Column 7 would identify a change in property type when it transferred. The bulk, of course, is residential.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski wants to interrupt you already.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Well, Mr. Chair, I thought would be what's happening here, you can hear us all rustling our papers, is what would be really interesting to see everybody's.
Because, like, I'm looking at mine, and I've made this argument, Representative Lanning and I have talked about this, actually, at length, and Representative Marquardt and I, you know, take a city like mine, and they're 93% correct, you know, the majority of the time, and you just go out a little chunk, and, I mean, they're pretty much doing it right. And I look over here at Representative Marquardt's, and it's 34%, and part of the issue, I think, related to these assessments is who's got the big budget and the big staff and the big expertise and the big money to put it assessing. And it'd be great to see everybody, so that's all I was going to add. And have you ever noticed that the cities with a lot of resources are doing a better job than the cities without, or is that just something in my mind that's not accurate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lachinsky, there is probably some relationship between good budgets and good assessment, but it's not necessarily a proven fact.
Okay.
What's more to the point, and we do have copies for everybody on the thought that on the chance you might ask for it, so we do have that. Probably a better explanation is the similarity. I knew I couldn't say that word. The similarities of the communities. For instance, a Bloomington might be easier to assess than a St. Paul, where you have much more similar housing stock of similar ages. You'll notice Shoreview has a pretty tight gap. Minnetonka looks quite good, too. On the other hand, you look at Virginia, which looks, if you just glance at it, you might think that the assessor in Virginia is not doing a particularly good job. Now, that could speak
to a very good job.
You might think that, and you would probably be in error if you thought that. There's a lot of things going on in Virginia. Number one, the economy is probably not as strong as it is in a lot of places. So you have different factors taking place in the market where some houses are not always selling they're not always optimizing their investment. You have a lot of different housing stock. You have new houses, old houses. So the more similar your housing stock, the better off you are. You also, as we were looking at this information, I anticipated I might get asked why Shoreview has such a tight center in St. Paul's a little bigger. And I asked the Ramsey County assessor that, and the explanation I got was, in Ramsey County, again, you have very different economic conditions. You have very different housing stock, new housing, old housing. And another issue they have in the city of St. Paul is a lot of times people are doing work, non-permitted work on their properties. They're not taking out permits. And when the property sells, they'll identify that there was a lot of work in that structure that was not permitted. Consequently, escape detection from assessment, which does not typically happen in the suburbs like Shoreview, for instance.
Hmm. Mr. Hagan, I'm looking at the residential and the variances, and they seem to be more towards the majority of them, just in this one locale, of 75% of them, or the majority of them seem to be between 75 and 90. But when I look at the commercial, about 60% of them actually sold for less than their assessed value, which seems to again indicate that the commercial might be a little more aggressively valued. That's a pretty high percentage to be outside that realm. But I don't know if you want to talk about that. I understand Mr. Hallstrom's here, Martin County Assessor, and may want to jump in on this. You know, if you'd like to add to the discussion, you could. Come on down.
If I might add briefly, too, that just to help to further explain these graphs we handed out, or the charts, it's basically a snapshot in time. It encompasses sales that occurred from September of 2004, and it's all based against the 2004 assessment data, is how the ratios are calculated. So you know what we're talking about.
Mr. Hallstrom.
Good morning. I'm Jim Hallstrom. I'm the county assessor at Martin County. I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Just as the way of preliminaries, our association has had a longstanding policy or a position opposing any items such as limited market value. It believes adjustments to market value, such as limitations, acquisition values, deferments, exemptions, does create inequities between taxpayers. And I believe that through the discussion that we've had this morning, initially when it was started in 1993, I believe the intent was not to let limited value be a long-standing process. However, the further we have gotten into the process, it kind of compounds upon itself. So I think we're at a position with Representative Lanning's bill of even going a couple more years. It's just going to continue to compound the issue. At some point, we need to get back to market value being the prime determination of property tax revenues.
Thank you, Mr. Hallstrom. Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, there's people that have come a long way to support these limited market value bills that aren't from around the Department of Revenue building or wherever, so maybe we have them come up and testify. So,
yes, Representative Rukavina, we will. We're just kind of, as soon as we finish up on this, we've kept plenty of time for the testimony. Do members have any other questions on their runs that they want to talk about? Everybody understands them. Representative Lanning?
I may have missed this in explanation, but what does it mean on this sale price adjusted for time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, my name is Leonard Peterson. I supervise the sales ratio unit in the Minnesota Department of Revenue. What we're required to do when we conduct a sales ratio study is take the assessor's estimated market value as of January 2nd, the assessment date, and compare it to sales that take place within our study period, which was October 1st, 2003 through September 30th, 2004. But because there could be inflation or deflation or creative financing going on in some of those sales, we try to do a cash equivalency adjustment on anything that is a non-market rate, if you had a contract for deed or an assumed mortgage. And then we also try to make an inflation adjustment to get the date of sale as if it had occurred on January 2nd.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
The first
another question, Representative Lanning.
Yes, to follow up, the first column here then is the sale price, and then the sale price adjusted for time is what the explanation you just gave. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And the percentage variance is based on the adjusted sale price?
That's correct.
Okay.
We use the adjusted, it's the assessor's estimated market value for 2004, which would be column 13, mm-hmm. divided by the sale price adjusted for time and terms, column 12.
Okay. All right. Is there anyone here who would like to testify for the bill? And we do have some people on the list, so we'll, for or against, if I can find it. There we go. Jeff Forrester.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have some handouts here.
Thank you, Mr. Forrester. And what's that saying that you had on your letter that was really good?
Cabins are where families happen.
Yes. Cabins are where families happen. That's very good. Mr. Forrester.
Where they're created.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Jeff Forrester, and I am Executive Director of Seasonal Recreational Property Owners, MSRPO. MSRPO represents 120,000 cabin families in Minnesota. I want to thank the committee for holding this hearing on the proposed limited market value laws and the members of the committee for their time today. In December of 1998, House Research published a history of limited market value. In it, they stated, LMV was designed to mitigate rising property taxes, which resulted from rapidly inflating property values. That year, the average estimated market growth value of seasonal recreational property statewide was 5.36%. In the fall of 2001, or in the spring of 2001, the state began to phase out the LMV statute. In the fall of 2001 was the attack of 9/11, an unforeseeable event. Beyond the human tragedy, other consequences were a troubled stock market and low interest rates. Wall Street-weary investors began to look to real estate instead of stocks and bonds. These factors are magnified on Minnesota Lakeshore property, however, and the market pressure there is intense. One local assessor in St. Louis County told me, "We used to mine iron ore, now we mine Lakeshore." In 2001, the statewide market value increase on seasonal recreational property was 15.6%. In 2002, the average increase was 17.7%. 2003, 20.6%. In 2004 through 2006, some areas are experiencing value increases of more than 30% as a projection. From 1998 to 2005, the net share of market value on seasonal recreational property rose from 3% to almost 4.5% statewide. The estimated market value of cabins has risen from $6,492 million to $18,425 million proposed for 2005. The Department of Revenue reports that the market value limitation on seasonal recreational lands, i.e. the amount of the value thus far protected from taxation by limited market value, and therefore regained as LMV expires, was very high for cabins at 23.94%. The averages were the highest in the north and north central counties. In the Brainerd area, roughly 31% of the taxable value has been shielded from taxation by LMV and will be recaptured as LMV phases out. The phase-out was intended to regain the lost value from limited market value slowly, but in the case of cabins, market values have been growing faster than the phase-out. There is more value excluded by LMV on seasonal recreational property today than there was in 2001 when the phase-out began. Although there was no way to predict it in the spring of 2001, the timing of the phase-out of LMV could not have been worse for cabin owners. In fact, cabin owners will take a bigger tax increase hit in 2007 than they would have in 2001 had LMV simply expired then. I have been told when talking about the rapidly increasing values on cabins, boy, I wish I had that problem. Indeed, for the owner who jumped into the market in 2001, the land speculator, Minnesota Lakeshore has been wildly profitable. But few seasonal recreational property owners in Minnesota are speculators. Cabins are heirlooms, not assets, for the majority of owners. And now I'll direct you to the study that we just compiled by, we had an independent researcher do a phone survey of over 500 cabin owners in the state. And we discovered that the average cabin property has been in ownership for 24 years. Only 8% bought their properties as an investment. 86% do not want to sell their properties, and 30% of those said they hope to leave the property to their families. Minnesota resident seasonal property owners use, on average, Minnesota resident seasonal property owners are, on average, 62 years old. The average seasonal property owner's household income is $58,383 a year. 55% of seasonal property owners are retired. 45% live on fixed incomes. 6% of the current seasonal property owners, over 72,000 families, fear they may have to sell in the next 3 years because they cannot afford the taxes. I would like to share with you just a few of the many letters I have received on this issue in the last few months. Mr. Stephen Tilo wrote to me on January 30th, "Yes, you are correct. Like the town assessor told me years ago, you own Lake Superior frontage, then you can afford to pay frontage taxes. Well, after 40 years of owning this property and seeing my tax bill of $5.77, and that was in 1945 when cabin properties got the taconite credit, go up to $3,120 for this property, 1999, and no taconite credit, I was forced to sell. Yes, I sold it at a profit. Bought it for $10,000 and sold it for $250,000, but I would have preferred to keep my shack on Lake Superior. I am 83 years old and have fought the good fight. Let the new generation fight on." Sue Ensminger from New Brighton wrote, "We are not rich, just hanging in, exclamation points. Gordon Swenson wrote, "Taxes got the better of us. We sold last July." Greg and Rita Skoll of Chaska wrote, "5 years ago, I retired as the Chaska police chief. It was always our dream to have a lake cabin for family activities. We have 7 grandchildren. I'm happy to say that we were able to accomplish our dream. We did this through sacrifice and paying additional on our mortgage. We were then able to afford a new mortgage on a modest cabin in the Brainerd area. 5 years ago when we bought, the taxes were $1,750. This past year, they were up to $3,323. My property taxes in Chaska are $3,016. Property taxes are now about 10% of my pension. If limited market value law is not reinstated, the property taxes in our cabin will soar even greater than they have over the past few years. Like many other retired folks, we are not wealthy and live on a fixed income. Taxes may force us to sell. These people cannot vote in the districts in which they are taxed and so have no control over local spending. They do not get the homestead credit, taconite credit, or many of the other buy-downs other properties enjoy. They are not protected by any circuit breaker or targeted tax relief provisions, and so will have to pay any tax increase, no matter how large. They are saddled with the state general tax, a $42 million burden last year, and are the only non-income producing included in this tax. Seasonal recreational owners were told that, according to House research projections, that they should expect 11% reduction in their tax bill following the tax reform of 2001. And the next year, the average tax break was 0.3%. Since then, tax bills have been rising dramatically, with some seeing over 100% tax increase in a single year. I have some tax statements here that are 123% increase in tax bill in a single year. Seasonal properties are not wealthy, and their land is not an investment. The timing of the phase-out of LMV was disastrous for a number of property owners. I'm here to ask you on behalf of the 120,000 families who choose to spend their vacation time and dollars in Minnesota to stop the phase-out of LMV and reinstate it permanently. Old-time owners should not be penalized by the speculative ventures of investors, but as people bid up the land, that is exactly what is happening. Long-time owners, Minnesota families, are literally being taxed off their family heritage. All four of these LMV bills simply protect owners from an overstimulated market. LMV was originally passed for these reasons. In 1993, legislators thought that a 5.3% annual increase deserved some protection. Some of you were here then. How much more justified is the LMV statute today than it was in 1993? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time. A lot of good people are looking for your help. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina.
Well, you know, Mr. Chair and members, Jeff, I sympathize with you, but, you know, there were a few inaccuracies in your statement. First of all, the guy in Lake Superior never got taconite homestead credit in 1945 because there were no taconite mines in 1945. They didn't start mining till 1955, and they didn't give a taconite homestead till 1979. So I don't know how this guy could say that he got a taconite homestead in 1945. There was no taconite, and the taconite homestead credit didn't start till 79. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I was quoting his letter.
Of course.
So I can misquote. I mean, I can quote letters too. I can tell you that doesn't happen, and that's an incorrect statement. As far as fixing your problem, however, we have to do something because, you know, I grew up at a cabin too, and that cabin's gone. And I hate to bring up Auntie Gloria, but I will because that's the cabin it was. And Auntie Gloria had to sell the cabin in the mid-80s because she needed her, I think at the time, third hip surgery. And the Aero shirt factories where she worked for 30-some years on the range got outsourced, and she lost her job. And it's pretty hard for a single woman to find a job on the Iron Range back then. And she had to sell her cabin. So I understand what you're talking about. But a lot of, and not in your case, because you're actually a long time, you actually qualify as an Iron Ranger, even though you weren't born there, because your great-grandfather was the mining captain in Tower, a sedan, will forgive you for that. But, you know, your family's been around a long time on Lake Vermilion, and I understand your dilemma. But a lot of this problem is caused by the very same people that have come here and wanted to get this break. And a lot of this problem was caused by the same people that came here and didn't want to pay local school taxes, but wanted to shift it back on to the same people who's had cabins for three and four generations up in those school districts. So your solution at the time to solving your problem wasn't fair to the local taxpayers either. Now you're stuck in that terrible statewide property tax, which I agree you shouldn't be on either. But if you get off of that, are your members willing to start paying school district excess levies again, even though they don't have a vote? And by the way, in this country, you get one vote. One person, one vote. You don't get three votes because you own three pieces of property. That's unconstitutional. But if we took the cabin tax off, the statewide cabin tax, would you folks be willing to pay the excess levy again in return?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riccovino, I don't have an exact number as to what the value of the school operating levies was last year. So I don't know if the local, because it was my understanding that the state general tax revenues were intended to be returned or set up in a school education fund, and I don't think that happened. So I don't know if the local school districts would make out better or worse if we were on the state general tax and off the school operating levies or vice versa. The state general tax as it is now is difficult because we're a non-income producing property, but perhaps the one benefit, the small benefit, is that we're at the state level. It used to be we'd come to the state and the state would say, well, we don't levy property taxes, and we go to the locals and we'd say, well, we're following the state regulations. And at least this way we have some voice, you know. Does that answer your question?
Does your bill applies to seasonal rec property too?
All property.
Yeah. And your bill, does your bill address the issue that if a person from Chicago or Minneapolis or wherever wants to come to Lake Vermilion and pay, you know, $200,000 for a shack with 110 feet of shoreline and then bulldoze the shack and put up another $200,000 cabin on it, does your bill say that person's going to start paying on $200,000 right away?
Yes, I believe it would not protect them. Right. It provides for a faster recapture on sales. And it also, I believe, and my intent is that if you bought and built, you still get that 1 year delay on the new construction, but you would be taxed at the full value, wouldn't you?
Miss
Baker?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that your bill addresses new construction. And I think if somebody from Chicago came and built a $1 million place, it would not do anything differently than current law. What it would do is if, in fact, there was a lake home on Vermilion and somebody from Chicago came and purchased it, then a 20% increase would take effect in the first year of that transfer. I mean, a maximum of 20%.
Right. It wouldn't affect the new one, but the new one would be valued as a new construction, wouldn't it? I mean, it wouldn't be protected under limited market value in that case.
Mr. Chairman, to the degree that I think a lot of people think that new construction is valued at a higher sales ratio because you know costs, then that's true.
Okay.
That they would be at a higher market value, you know, if there is some correlation between with new construction, you do have those figures, and so assessors, you know, and you can ask assessors this question,
there,
but I think
there wouldn't be anything in the higher bill to hold that value down, right?
No.
So it would
I'm concerned, and if that's your intent, I agree with you wholeheartedly, because if the person comes up and there is a piece of property on the lake valued at $150,000 and they pay $350,000 for it, I think that the next year their tax should be based on $350,000.
And I don't disagree with that, Representative Riccovino, and that's something that we could look at.
Yeah, I know.
Well,
but is that the way
they don't? Well, we could get into a long explanation. Do you want to explain the?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riccovino, what you'd have to do is you'd have to actually put in the bill that acquisition value is what the assessor would use in the year after it was transferred or purchased or whatever for whatever that sale price was. And there have been bills in the past that have done that, but obviously they haven't passed. But that's something that has been talked about, that would be acquisition value. And that is not in Representative Vandeveer's bill, per se.
That would be pretty problematic, I think, to try and do, but we could talk about it. But I think if I got the gist of your original question is there would be nothing to hold the value down on that. The assessor would go out and value it as they normally do. This bill wouldn't do anything to hold that value down like it would other properties where the assessed value increased dramatically. So we could ask the assessors here. Maybe you can answer the question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Recovina. As the law stands right now, new construction is not eligible for a limitation on value increase. So in the example given, if they came in, bought a property, raised the cabin, and built a $200,000 home, the value attributable to the home, the new home, would not be subject to limitation. However, if there were other changes made to the value, particularly affecting land, say they had to increase the land value substantially, there may be some limitation of value, but it's going to be very small because it would just be attributable to the property that was there prior to the new construction. So if the land went up significantly, there might be some limitation on that. That was not caused by new construction, but the new improvements would not be subject to limitation. Hopefully that's clear as mud.
I think we want to kind of move along. If there's no other... Did you have a question? Okay, Mr. Hammerson. And Mr. Hammerson, you are still the front runner for the best I don't know answer in the 2005 session from last time you were here.
Thank you very much. I've got something to distribute, please.
The page.
My name is Marlo Hammerson. I'm the chairman of the Tax Committee of the Minnesota Senior Federation. The Minnesota Senior Federation supports the extension of the limited market value. It will keep many seniors in their homes a little longer. However, there are two points we wish to make. One is that the percent of limited market value increase should be equal to the cost of living, not 10, 12, or 15%. Property taxes are paid from one's income, not from some extraneous number about the sale of real estate. Local governments should be able to live within their means, just as taxpayers must live within the cost of living adjustments that they experience. Second is that everyone here today must recognize that this legislation does not solve the property tax problem. This is a Band-Aid. It is a much-needed Band-Aid, but it is not the solution to the property tax problem. A week or so ago, I listened to a presentation by the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And until then, I didn't realize how crafty we seniors really are in making money in the real estate market. How selling cabins and homes and transferring back and forth really would make us money. So I passed out some information about the property tax history of a Minnesota Senior Federation member and his cabin and home in the metro area and how the limited market value works for him. And this is longer than you need to be kept. The important things is if in 2006 his limited market value is $475,000, it's going to go to an estimated market value of $633,100. That's a $158,000 increase he would experience if the limited market value goes away. I don't know how many of us could stand that kind of an increase. You notice that in his home down in St. Anthony, a suburb of Minneapolis, there's not that kind of an increase that's going to take place. The main reason that he says that the assessor says his value of his property is worth $633,100 is the old saw that that's what somebody would pay for it, that they say that old arm's length transaction, whatever that means. If you look at the bottom three lines, if he was trying to sell his home and the buyer could find a mortgage at 6% for 30 years, it would cost him $45,533 per year to buy the home. His property taxes would be roughly $6,331, which means in order to own that cabin, he's going to have to put into the cabin over $51,000 a year. If he wants to pay it off in a shorter period of time, 10 years, he'd have to be spending $90,000 a year. Now, I don't know what neighborhood you live in, but I don't live in a neighborhood with people with that kind of money. And it's fiction. It's fiction that you're basing the taxes upon, and it should be based on reality. What a person can afford to pay. Better look again at Representative Vandeveer's 992. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Amerson. Any questions? Okay, Jack Horner. Could you... Mr. Horner, you came to sing the praises of these bills?
I came to discuss them, Mr. Chairman. Jack Horner, Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Actually, I did come to discuss them. I should start out by saying that I truly do understand the appeal, the allure of the limited market value. I very much understand the stories presented today and last week at a hearing regarding commercial seasonal recreational properties. Our concern is simply that the limited market value skews the property tax system. It disrupts it. It does it in surprising and kind of unpredictable ways in some respect. And it seems to me that we should just continue on with our six-year plan. These issues have been with us literally for decades. Limited market value has been on, off, on, off. And we reach the point where it's going to go off because it's sunsetted. And someone says, well, but look what it would do to these classes of property. And so it seemed clear that the only way that we were going to get rid of it is a rather lengthy phase-out, a six-year phase-out. This was enacted. I think we should just continue on with that. I'm talking specifically about the people that I represent, the apartments, according to the latest and recently released limited market value report for the Department of Revenue, for taxes payable in 2005. Apartments statewide, as a class, pay some 8% higher property taxes because of the existence of the limited market value law. In the metro area where the majority of apartments are, it's almost 9%, 8.58% higher property taxes because they're simply picking up value that should be paid and would be paid otherwise by other classes of property. It's pushed on over to apartments. And we've talked at great length, literally for some two decades, about tax incidents, about if you want affordable rental housing, we have to have costs that are somewhat limited to the extent possible. Costs always find their way into rent. That's no surprise to anybody. So when you impose additional costs on apartments, it necessarily must cause rents to go up to the extent the market allows. It's not direct tit for tat year by year, but clearly they find their way into the rent over a period of time. So apartments pay, and that means the renters pay some 9%, 8.58% of property taxes for other people, for other classes of property. Secondly, and what I think is most surprising is when you examine the Department of Revenue's data and listen to the analysis that they presented several weeks ago, several things become clear. In the area of homesteads, as was pointed out to this committee, some 70% of homeowners are hurt by limited market value. Everyone would naturally just assume, well, homeowners are one of the favored classes. Naturally, they all get the benefit. Even those that get some mark down in value temporarily for a year or two or three while it phases in, some 70% are hurt. That is, they pay more property taxes because of the existence of limited market value than they otherwise would pay. Only 68% to be exact, only 32% of homeowners are helped. Even in a highly favored class like seasonal recreational residential, the cabins, almost 22% would actually be hurt if limited market value were are hurt by the existence of limited market value. Even within that highly favored class, some 22% of cabin owners are paying more property taxes because of the existence of this law than they otherwise would. Last week, there was some very compelling argument and data presented on behalf of seasonal recreational commercial, the resorts. Statewide, resort owners, commercial resort owners, pay 11.9% more property tax because of the existence of the limited market value. Now, they don't get the benefit of the limited market value. Value is being pushed on to them to the extent that they are paying statewide 11.9% more. And when you figure out that percentage, and I won't go through the math, although I'd be happy to discuss with anyone who wants, when you go through the math, they would almost certainly be helped by simply getting rid of the limited market value law rather than applying it to them. In order to apply it to them and cut their taxes by 12%, it's more likely that, in my opinion, that they would be benefited by simply getting rid of the limited market value and not having all these other classes of property push onto them. My argument is that we should simply continue the phase out. Finally, limited market value makes it very difficult to tell for any individual property taxpayer whether he's being hurt or not. It goes absolutely contrary to the discussions of truth in taxation and visibility of taxes and accountability of taxes and people knowing what their taxes are. For example, just in my home in Maplewood where I live, I've got my tax statement there recently, and it points out the limited market value. It goes through the math, estimated market value, limited market value. I look like I'm getting some benefit from the limited market value, but I don't know. Because when I go through the Department of Revenue's data, county by county, city by city, showing who's hurt and who's helped, I turn to Ramsey County, Maplewood, 50% of the homes are hurt by limited market value, 50% are helped. I don't know which one I am. My tax statement doesn't say.
You would be helped, Mr. Harnett.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, let it be said that I don't know, however, actually, by looking at the data and by looking at my tax return, so or my tax statement. It does seem to me that we should continue on because it's not clear who's being helped or hurt. Clearly, it skews the system. Clearly, the people I represent attempting to provide rental housing, much of it in the affordable housing range, are clearly hurt, and it does seem to me as though we should allow the phase-out to continue on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, yeah, we do have people from out of town, but I think it's clear that Mr. Horner likes House File 890, Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Horner, you mentioned that continuing limited market value would increase potentially property taxes for apartments and therefore rents for renters. Did the inverse were true when in 2001 we reduced property classification rates almost by 50% over time? Did rents go down at that time?
Mr. Chairman, actually, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Yeah, they have. Rents have been stable. That is to say they're the very same that they were in 2000 as they are now. This is by quarterly studies that are done. That GVA Marquette does a quarterly study. This is metro area. I don't know of anybody who systematically reviews rents outstate, but anecdotal evidence indicates that vacancies are high and therefore rents are stable. And in real economic data, when you take into account inflation and increasing costs of rental housing and the giveaways that you can see now in the paper, rents are actually decreased. This is clearly in part due to the property tax reform. It's also due to two other factors also. The business recession, which is now picking up, the fact that interest rates on homes have been very, very low, and so people rush to buy homes that maybe a little sooner than they otherwise would have. But clearly there's been a lot of building in apartments clearly instigated by property tax reform, and it's one of the major factors in indeed holding rents stable.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. And Mr. Horner is almost as fun as Mr. Dorfman, but we have people from out of town that we are going to get to when we have sessions. So, Representative Mullery?
Mr. Chairman, real quick question. I was just going to say, isn't it true that vacancies are up and that's a factor, too?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right. Vacancies are up. That's the mechanism that holds rents stable. Absolutely. Sure. More supply means vacancies, means rents are stable.
And while Representative Rukavina asks you a question, Joe McGarland, if you could come down. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Horner, I've got evidence that the rents went up and have been going up. So I left it in my saved items in the main tax committee. But, they're coming down. What's the justification for your apartment not being on the statewide tax? They make income.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just comment. Thank you. I'll get the data that we have. It's metro area data, what the industry relies on. It's done quarterly surveys, some several hundred thousand apartment units each year, or over 100,000.
Mr. Horner, you could get that for Representative Rukavina. That would be helpful.
I will do that. Thank you.
Was there another?
Well, and the other question is, apartments still pay more property taxes, 25% more, a high amount more than homesteads do. It's the same people. It's people living in homes, but for some reason, because they rent, we think that we should make them pay higher property taxes on equivalent value than people who own their homes. Mm-hmm. That's a policy decision, but even without being on the state tax, we are still much higher than homeowners pay.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. McCarling.
My name is Joseph McAuley. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and my thanks to all who should receive thanks and apologies for my lack of experience here and the culture. I am a resident of Edina that recently bought, a home on Gull Lake. To my surprise, and I have in front of me my tax statements. I can provide those to the page if it's appropriate. My taxes would have gone up less than $50. In effect, the taxes went up an additional $7,167 because of a state tax. I knew nothing about the general property tax from the state. I found that surprising at the time. I am not only a resident of Edina, I have a property in New Jersey. That property tax is interesting because there they provide me with a form each year that says out-of-state residents need not apply for the rebate. In Florida, they have a cap on resident taxes that they don't have for non-residents. So clearly the states have taken actions in favor of their residents. I found out now in Minnesota, because of the increase in taxes, we decided to take aim at our own residents. And because you live in Edina and you homestead there, you can't pay the same taxes you would have paid otherwise. That I found very confusing, and you've got the documentation. I then talked to some of my neighbors and found out the application of the tax is uniform or equitable. Some, as has been pointed out in this meeting, some of the homes are being appraised at 30, 40, or 50% of the fair market value of the home. Mine's closer to two-thirds. How does that work, and then how does that make this situation further exacerbated? So I'm looking at seniors and some of my neighbors. Let me pause for a second. It's clear I can afford this tax. To afford the $7,000 isn't going to drill me. It will represent a single-digit percentage of the total taxes I paid in this state. But I can't say that for my neighbors. I can't say that for the seniors on the street and some people down the street. And I wonder why we have a principle-centered approach here to taxes that favors out-of-state people and discourages in-state taxes. I see some of you are looking at the numbers. So my request is, as you look at this limited value tax, or whatever you call it, limited market value, and I apologize for not knowing exactly your topic or being able to relate to it.
That's okay. If you knew too much, we'd have to be suspicious of you.
I can assure you I do not. But what I do know is that I am an expert on my own taxes, and I'm very in touch with them this week in particular. And what I'm seeing is something that is somewhat scary. Why would I want to move to Wisconsin and buy my second home there, or my home for my kids, which is really what we've done up in the Brainerd area. So I've been encouraged to move to Wisconsin. Well, other states are encouraging me to stay out, and I can't figure out how this works. So as you look at this whole issue, this is a very serious attended issue, and I wish you'd give it some consideration to just pitch it. Thank you.
Well, Mr. McCarlin, thank you for taking the time to come down and and provide some input on this. Any questions for Mr. McCarlin? Why we're doing that? If Juris Kriskis, Representative Rukamina, how do you pronounce that?
I don't see the agenda, Mr. Chair.
Is Mr. Sirisky here? Sirisky's? Okay, Barbara Robertson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Barbara Robertson, and Jeff from MSRPO asked me to come and tell my story. I'm a school teacher, a part-time teacher in the Robbinsdale District for students that are expelled. So they're all anxious to hear about my day in court. Some of them have their day in court. My story goes back to 1942, before I was born, when my parents bought land on Leech Lake. My father was an athlete. He was a pitcher, a baseball pitcher. He had to quit because he hurt his arm, became a teacher. He bought mother golf clubs. She couldn't hit the ball. He bought her a tennis racket. She couldn't hit the ball. He bought her a fishing pole. She caught fish. So they decided that they wanted to have land up north. During World War II, he worked at Honeywell at night, earned $2,500 teaching during the day. They heard about three pieces of land, one on Gull, one on Leech, and one on Inguadona. They bought the land on Leech, sight unseen, in the winter because they always had the best fishing there, for $2,000. He had $500 left to build the 22-by-22-foot cabin. I lived there every summer all my life. I was born in 1945. Back in 1981, well, in 82, I had lost my father, mother, and husband to death. So I inherited the cabin with my sister. And in 1984, the cabin was worth, when we finally did all the estate, the cabin was worth a little over $100,000, and I bought a home in Golden Valley around $100,000. Today, my home in Golden Valley is assessed in the low 300s, and I was able to pick up one piece of land next to my cabin for $25,000 and another piece of beach for $8,000. So that, along with the family property I inherited, is now worth, according to my new statements, $1,348,000. I pull the plug every year. We can't start the water till the ground is thawed. What has greatly affected our area up there is there was a wonderful resort called Forest View Resort, built in the 20s. I worked there as a kid. And it was sold 3 years ago to a developer from Naples, Florida. He bought the 65 acres for $3.7 million. 10 lots were plotted on the point, Forest View Point, and 10 behind. The lots are around 1.2 acres. They're going for $640,000 to $840,000 a lot. Three of them have been sold. He has built large homes on them, $1,400,000, $1,300,000. The lots behind are less, $250,000. When I talked to the assessor, my piece of beach that I bought for $8,000 is all wetlands behind it. You can't ever build on it. The only access through it is through my other property. So a couple years ago, my assessor brought that from $14,000 up to $74,000 in his assessed value. So I called him because I had been up there prior years, and I learned that that doesn't do anything. And he said, all right, Barbara, I realize that went up a little high. I figured it was just a computer-generated deal. So he brought it back to $20,000. Then the next year he brought it up to $89,000. And I called him again last year. I said, why did you bring it from $20,000 to $89,000? He said, well, Barbara, I'll have to raise everything else up if I bring that down. So this year's assessments, that beach is now up to $129,000. The piece I bought for $25,000 is $261,000, and the piece my parents sacrificed for is $957,000. Obviously, I teach part-time. I am going to be 60 in September. I am not wealthy. I will not be able to, I would want to leave this land to my children. I don't know how to do it, and I'm here to talk about hopefully getting some tax relief for cabin owners. Any questions?
Thank you. Anybody have any questions? I think it's great that you came down today to share that with us. We're kind of hearing it from a lot of people. So,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rukavina.
Is there a way for our tax experts to figure out a constitutional way to let these families that have been in for two, three generations get a better rate than the guy from Chicago?
You don't like those Chicago guys, do you?
Well, they're the ones that are buying the $600,000.
Yeah. Naples.
I don't think anyone's buying the $84,000 swamp, though.
Seriously, is there a way constitutionally to do it?
Ms. Baker. Okay.
Mr. Michaels, is there a way to unconstitutionally do it?
Probably not.
Representative Lanning, would you like to move the April 6th minutes?
So moved.
Thank you. Any additions or deletions or... Okay, all in favor of the April 6th, 2005 minutes? Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. I'll move the adoption of the April 7th, 2005 minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The minutes are adopted. Anything else? We're adjourned.